The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Quitting time? After Super Tuesday, a pair of Southern state primaries could reduce the number of non-Romneys to one, or not.
Bombs away? The tactical, political, and philosophical debate over Washington's support for military action against an Iranian nuclear weapon.
Fighting cyber censorship, press freedom groups debate internet oversight, restraints, and responsibility.
Anatomy of Injustice, Pulitzer Prize winner Ray Bonner has a new book about a murder case gone wrong and what it says about the American judicial system.
Cautiously optimistic, a cast of famous performers give young songwriter Scott Evan Davis good reason for the sentiment behind the title track of his new CD.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Production of Gatewave Incorporated, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of March 11th and Daylight Savings Time, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
It's been a long road getting to Super Tuesday. Let me be honest. And my opponents have worked very hard.
I'm asking for your help and support on Tuesday. You do that. You deliver a victory for us on Tuesday. You will make this a two-person race. And once it's a two-person race, the conservative will be the nominee. You can change it all, Mississippi.
We are going on to Alabama. We're going on to Mississippi. We're going on to Kansas.
Mitt Romney's nod to his continuing opposition after Super Tuesday only underscored how the big 10-state competition failed to nail down his long-claimed inevitability as the GOP presidential nominee. Whether races in Alabama and Mississippi this week reduce his realistic opposition to one, as Rick Santorum devoutly wished, also remained to be seen. With more and more party leaders distraught by the pitched primary siege, Newt Gingrich did indicate he had to score at least one more Southern win after his home state Georgia victory last week to remain a realistic national contender. But Newt quickly canceled plans for contesting Kansas to concentrate on that make-or-break goal.
To consider calls for quitting time in the GOP race, the continuing importance of social issues, and fading economic arguments after three straight months of growth, 227,000 jobs added in February. For your ears only, we're joined again by Boston Globe national political editor Don McGillis. Welcome back to our program, Don.
Good morning.
Do you see the roller coaster primary season strengthening the eventual nominee as a campaigner, or at least making his political baggage too boring for Democrats to exploit in the fall? Or has it weakened the party's brand overall?
I think it's weakened the party brand. I think it's exposed issues that the Republican Party would really not like to have discussed during a campaign, that they want to be almost exclusively about economic issues. I think Mitt Romney were really sailing to the nomination now, he might not have backed that blunt amendment, which would allow employers not to cover a wide range of health services.
Can you see Gingrich ignoring even a double Southern loss this week to fight on?
I think it would be very difficult for him to do that. He has talked about possibly getting out if he does, and right after Super Tuesday, he said they've got to do well in the South. I think it would be very, very difficult for him. He is quite dependent on one donor to his Super PAC, and I would think that that donor, Sheldon Adelson, would have to sit down with him and really think things over.
Rush Limbaugh kept the debate over contraceptive health care coverage alive last week with an apology for calling a Georgetown Law School student who testified for it a slut and prostitute, but continuing to lose sponsors. Can Democrats continue to exploit this issue?
Well, they can because of that Blunt Amendment that I mentioned, which is sort of the congressional parallel to what Rush Limbaugh got involved in, and there's talk in the House of Representatives of the Republicans there trying to put through their version of that, which I think would be a great mistake for them because it keeps that issue in front of the electorate at a time when that's not what any of the Republican nominees would benefit from.
The contraception debate also showed us something about Catholic voters, especially their response to Catholic candidate Santorum.
Yes, he did surprisingly badly among Catholic voters in several of the primaries. Mitt Romney did definitely better, even though Rick Santorum, of course, is a very devout Catholic. I think that simply reflects the fact that Catholics are a very, very large and far from monolithic group in the United States, and I think in polls show that most of them, go, especially Republican Catholics, go into the voting booth much more concerned about the economy than about an issue like contraception.
It also didn't help that Santorum said he almost vomited over John Kennedy's famous speech about the separation of church and state.
John Kennedy remains an iconic figure among American Catholics. When I first heard that, I was driving in my car. I almost drove off the road when I first heard that from Rick Santorum, I must say.
How do you see the role of foreign affairs in the campaign now, with Obama charging that Romney, Santorum, even Gingrich are beating the drums of war over Iran's nuclear program, John McCain calling for airstrikes to stop the massacres in Syria?
Unless something happens in one of those trouble spots overseas, I don't see it playing a big role. Look at the position of somebody like Mitt Romney toward Iran. It's really not all that different from President Obama's position, and I don't think there's a great deal of appetite in the American public for new wars, either in Syria or Iran. So I just don't see that. But again, if something dramatic happens overseas, it would definitely put that out front again. But right now, the whole Obama position about foreign affairs is summed up in that phrase you keep hearing them saying that under Obama, Osama bin Laden is dead and GM is alive.
What do Globe reporters say about Romney's celebrated financial advantage and where it stands after all the primaries where he's vastly outspent each leading non-Romney? Any question his war chest, super PAC support and organization can hold up through the convention?
We're getting signs that that they are having to scramble a little bit more there. And you have to differentiate between the campaign itself and his super allied super PAC. And the campaign itself has apparently tapped out with some of its most generous donors. And they're, in his last two victory speeches after primaries, Mitt Romney has made reference to his supporters possibly going to his website to donate. And they have not done very well with small amount donors so far, but this is probably going to change. I think they'll steer more toward them. Then the broader question is how this will all stand up during the general election. And the crucial thing to watch is whether or not Mitt Romney dips into his own fortune as he did 4 years ago.
Some say the rise of super PACs has artificially extended the GOP competition, keeping in candidates who otherwise would have had to drop out. What's your view on that and whether some new version of campaign finance reform might next take its place?
Well, to answer the second part of your question, I don't see much likelihood that this is going to be a major change, because that Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, really set the ground rules, I think, certainly at the federal level. But getting back to, yes, I think the super PACs that have been supporting Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich have definitely been a factor in keeping them going, and it's quite possible that they would have dropped out by now. But the other thing that's keeping them going is the sheer volatility of this campaign right from the beginning. And candidates like Santorum and Gingrich now look at Tim Pawlenty, who pulled out very early, and is reported to have had certain second thoughts about that later on, that if he had stayed in, he might be a very viable candidate now. So people just don't really know how this is going to play out, and I think that's a factor, as well as the super PAC money that's kept Santorum and Gingrich going.
Don McGillis is national political editor of the Boston Globe.
Quote from the news, Hollywood lies are Hollywood lies. That was Sarah Palin on this weekend's HBO film adaptation of the book Game Change, focused mainly on the unsuitability of Palin as a VP nominee to spark John McCain's losing campaign in 2008. Palin also said she was available as a presidential nominee this year.
Next, more on war, Israel, Iran, Syria, and more for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. If you see a breach in the iron wall, it makes sense to try to go through it. That was 20-year-old Russian journalism student Vera Kichanoka after winning a seat on a Moscow district council, even as Vladimir Putin regained the presidency in questionable voting that continued to spark public outrage. Now this.
We've waited for diplomacy to work. We've waited for sanctions to work. None of us can afford to wait much longer.
This is not just an issue of Israeli interests. This is an issue of U.S. interests. It's also not just an issue of consequences for Israel if action is taken prematurely. There are consequences to the United States as well.
The war over war with Iran continued last week between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and between Obama and Republican presidential contenders, even as Obama tried to assure all concerned that in the end, one way or another, he would prevent Tehran from actually obtaining nuclear weapons that could threaten Israel's very existence and reshape the larger Middle East balance of power.
To consider the differing U.S. and Israeli red lines on the Iranian nuclear threat, the consequences of taking military action, and the politics of the debate, for your ears only, we're joined again by National Journal chief correspondent Michael Hirsch. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, happy to be back.
Obama pledged that he had Israel's back, but there is a difference between what he pledges to prevent and what Netanyahu calls unacceptable in terms of Iran's nuclear program. Talk about that.
Well, the essential difference is that the Israelis have talked for a long time about preventing the Iranians from getting the capability to build a nuclear bomb, by which they mean enough enrichment of highly enriched uranium that would give them one or more nuclear weapons, as well as the other technical advances that you would need. And the Iranians are considered very close to that, whereas Obama has talked about preventing a nuclear bomb, a nuclear weapon, which takes a little further down the road. In other words, as long as the Iranians don't actually build a bomb, even if they're capable of doing so, presumably that would be Obama's threshold. So there is considerable daylight there, and we don't know how successful they have been in closing it.
What is the best estimate on how much damage an Israeli attack soon could do to Iran's nuclear program, given how much of it is now buried deep underground?
Well, that's the key thing that has caused the tensions to really roil up over this issue now at this particular moment. It is believed that this new underground facility built into the mountains near the religious city of Qom, a facility called Fordo, is going to be impregnable enough once it becomes the main enrichment site, and they're just now in the process of transferring centrifuges over there. It will be impregnable enough to probably withstand the best the Israelis can throw at it from the air. Whereas the United States, it is believed, has the bigger bunker buster bombs and the greater capacity to probably take out that site, anytime it really wanted to do so. So the question becomes, if the Israelis decide not to attack and Fordo becomes fully operational, will the Israelis trust Barack Obama and the U.S. government enough to believe that the Americans will act and attack if the Iranians get close to a bomb? And that was really mainly what Obama and Netanyahu were arguing about.
Well, let's take a step back. I mean, what's the worst that Israel could do to Iran if it decides to go ahead and strike before it becomes not a viable operation for its forces? I mean, how much damage could they do to the Iran nuclear program?
That's also a question. The most optimistic estimates are they could set back the program a couple years. But the biggest concern, and I think certainly the most persuasive argument against a unilateral Israeli attack even now, is that unless the Israelis are brilliantly successful at truly stopping the Iranian program and doing devastating impact in an air or combined strikes, they might end up in a worse situation, in a more threatened situation than they were before. Why? Because Obama and the other Western allies have succeeded in building up a very powerful coalition against Iran, including very tough sanctions that are only getting tougher. If an Israeli attack occurs, you can almost bet that that coalition will begin to disintegrate, and the Iranians may be in a stronger position. They may be actually freer to build a bomb after an Israeli strike than before.
What's the likely fallout in terms of Iranian retaliation against a military strike on Israeli and American interest, oil supplies, and gas prices?
Well, most analysts have said that the impact could be devastating. You already see the evidence in rising gas prices that the markets are bidding up in anticipation of a possible confrontation, which could include the Iranians deciding to blockade or close the Straits of Hormuz, where a lot of oil is transported. The other potential retaliatory measures might include unleashing Hezbollah and Hamas against Israel. I tend to think that that those dire estimates are probably a little bit overstated. I don't think that Hezbollah and Hamas are about to attack Israel, even if there were an Israeli strike. And I think that Iran's ability otherwise to retaliate is somewhat limited. You got to remember the Iranian economy is virtually crippled already by sanctions, and its only sustenance really is oil. So they really do have to keep selling oil. So I question whether, in fact, the retaliatory capability of Tehran is that great.
How do you see the elections in Iran last weekend with President Ahmadinejad judged the big loser, affecting Tehran's nuclear program, whose non-military purposes apparently have widespread popular support in Iran?
Yeah, that's the results of that are difficult to read, except that it clearly was a very bad setback for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who has been battling with Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and while the Iranians continue to insist that their program is not, intent on building a nuclear weapon, that it's peaceful, is widely believed that it is. And Ahmadinejad was really the only one, as crazy as he sometimes is, who expressed a willingness to negotiate on the nuclear program. So, if anything, I think that this might indicate a hardening of the Iranian position vis-a-vis the nuclear program.
So how do you see the state of play now between Netanyahu and Obama?
Well, I think the key lies in that phrase that not Netanyahu used in his speech that you had on at the beginning of your program. The key phrase was, we can't wait much longer, much longer. It all is a question of how much longer. And whether Obama succeeded in their talks at the White House, which went on for about 3 hours, in persuading Netanyahu to wait, that he could trust the Americans, that he, Obama, would act if need be, and not to launch a unilateral strike. And I think that most of the sense we've got from talking with officials about those meetings is that Obama probably succeeded, that the Israelis may not strike, and they have not yet, as Israeli officials have told me directly, they have not yet made a decision to strike. So it all depends on how much longer, what it really means.
National Journal chief correspondent Michael Hirsch.
Quote from the news, watched in bed, was blown away. That was a tweet by TV star Ryan Seacrest on the viral YouTube video Kony 2012 that spotlights Joseph Rao Kony, head of the Ugandan guerrilla group Lord's Resistance Army, wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. Critics of the video condemn it for oversimplifying the Central African conflict.
Next, the campaign against cyber censorship. For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. Because he has confidence in the Egyptian judiciary and because he is certain of his innocence. That was Egyptian lawyer Tharwat Abdel Shahid on the decision of his client Robert Becker to be the only American remaining in Cairo to face criminal charges for work with U.S.-funded democracy training groups. Now this.
Reporters Without Borders organizes every year on March 12th the World Day Against Cyber Censorship. It's a special event dedicated to defend freedom of expression on the Internet.
Ideas from Christianity that have lasted for thousands of years on definition of marriage and relationships between human beings are now deemed to be so inflammatory they must be stricken from these Internet platforms.
The Internet, like politics, can make strange bedfellows. On the eve of World Day Against Cyber Censorship, as explained by Jean-François Julliard, former Secretary General of Reporters Without Borders, Fighters for Press Freedom, we heard Craig Parshall, Vice President of the National Religious Broadcasters in Washington last year, complain about the pressures of political correctness online. On one hand, China jails a blogger who publicized official land grabs and corruption. On the other, just last week, arrests of anonymous-related hacktivists after interrupting various government and business websites in retaliation for pressure to shut down WikiLeaks.
With a preview of these and other issues likely to dominate an international panel on Cyber Censorship Day this week in New York, for your ears only, Stefan Kaur, spelled K-O-C-H, is on the line with us. He's a Reporters Without Borders board member, vice president of Geneva-based High Tech Bridge SA, supplier of information security services, and founder of Intelligentsia.net. Welcome to our program.
Welcome.
What and where are the most egregious new examples of cyber censorship likely to be discussed at the March 12th panel?
We will discuss about the release of the Reporters Without Borders report of the enemy of the Internet. We will list several countries which are not, you know, complying with democracy, and we are tracking cyber dissident. And we are going to talk about country under surveillance, and as well, we are going to talk about the netizen prize we will give to some cyber dissident according to the work they have done during the year.
And what are the countries where cyber censorship is worse?
You know what was on the news recently. We can talk about Syria when bloggers and journalists were targeted and killed in some occasion because they want to give that information to everyone. I mean, the fact to want to make information public can kill today. And see, what we want to denounce and the fact that sometimes people get killed with a collaboration with companies which are based on our soil. I mean, it could be in the U.S., could be in the Switzerland, could be in the France, could be in the Germany. I mean, those companies are selling surveillance products, you know, to those raw countries. And then those countries are using those products to spy and to track dissidents, cyber dissidents, and sometimes to torture them or to kill them.
This tracking software technology has become very much a topic of issue in the United States, where there is a debate over how you balance, for instance, copyright assurances for content creators and the free-flowing Internet that maximizes expression, connection, creativity. How do you see that balance?
We cannot make much, you know, those companies with a problem of intellectual property or all those SOPA, PIPA Act or ACTA even, you know, there is really two worlds. But, I mean, of course, we have to balance intellectual property needs and the way of people accessing to the information of the free access to some information. If we take a case like a mega upload, of course, there is people who are making money in a bad way and a non-legal way by using, you know, copyrights that don't detain the rights. And then, on another side, you have people who just, you know, drop file in a legal way on those mega upload servers, which are not criminal, or get, you know, collateral damage from the fact a mega upload website was putting down. So, I mean, the way to balance is not only on the side of the user, it's the side of the authority as well.
Is there technology being developed that helps people avoid censorship, that disguises their place of origin, their point of access on the Internet, that gives them some protection?
There is technology. There is several initiatives, like a Tor project, you know, which can really help people and help journalists and bloggers to be more anonymous or to be less be able to be tracked by this surveillance company. The problem today is like journalists need to be trained with this new technology or this use of technology. And it's why we are going to organize at the Columbia University of Journalists a workshop on Monday morning. It's because we realize, as Reporters Without Borders, there is a big need of that. You know, recently in Syria, someone was arrested with his computer. After the government analyzed his computer, 30 person got arrested. 30 Syrian dissidents got arrested. Because today, I mean, computer, smartphone, and other devices are carrying sensitive information. And that information is really wandering, requested by those governments and sometimes by private companies as well.
What else does Reporters Without Borders do to protect or enhance Internet freedom?
We are going to create a platform which is a kind of receive sensitive documents which are forbidden to be published in several countries like raw countries, you know, non-democratic countries. And then we are going to, in a secure way, to receive those documents, to publish it, and to translate those documents in several languages, to avoid those kind of censorship. So Reporters Without Borders is doing that. Reporters Without Borders is as well, you know, receiving journalists like in Paris, trying to make them, you know, be able to stay in France or sometimes in some other country. They have a specific places for journalists to work in Paris, for instance. And there is several branch of Reporters Without Borders around the world. We are trying to be in contact with journalists or people, cyber dissidents, and so on, bloggers, to help them to comply with this, risk of censorship or risk on the life.
Stéphane Corr, spelled K-O-C-H, is a Reporters Without Borders board member, vice president of Geneva-based High-Tech Bridge SA, and founder of Intelligentsia.net. Monday's panel is a collaboration between the Swiss branch of Reporters Without Borders and New York-based Penn American Center. Next, Anatomy of Injustice, for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. When people love pigs, in my opinion, they are special and unique. That was Susan Magidson on her friend and fellow pig rescuer, Anna Gristana, a suburban New York housewife arrested last week on charges of running a multi-million-dollar brothel on Manhattan's Upper East Side for over 15 years. She said it was just a dating service. Now this.
This is a miscarriage of justice. This is injustice writ large. And I will spell it out for you with all the vehemence and passion that I have.
Call it a case of passion repaid, even as Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent Raymond Bonner was visiting places like Harvard's Shorenstein Media Center to tout his latest book, A Dozen Years in the Making, about a retarded black man named Edward Lee Elmore, railroaded to death row. An equally passionate and determined young lawyer succeeded in setting Elmore free after 30 years behind bars.
The book is Anatomy of Injustice, a murder case gone wrong from Knopf Publishers, both a great read and a sad indictment of prosecution American style. To talk about it, the case itself, and lingering sins of the larger justice system, for your ears only, Ray Bonner is on the line now. Former New York Times and New Yorker correspondent, he currently writes for Atlantic Magazine. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
First, tell us how you became aware of the Edward Lee Elmore case.
Yes, well, it goes back to 2000 and actually goes back to the presidential campaign then when George Bush appeared on, he was in the primary and he appeared on Tim Russert on Meet the Press, and Russert asked him about death row in Texas, and Bush said no innocent person has ever been executed in Texas and everybody's had a fair trial who's on death row, and the newspaper sent me down there to do some reporting and did, and that led to a year of reporting about capital punishment. And in the course of that, I heard about the Elmore case in South Carolina.
Ray, you've been quoted saying, you can only write a book when you cannot not write the book. It's got to be in your gut. What was it about this particular case that made it so compelling to you?
I mean, the case has all the elements that are involved in the death penalty debate. Race, mental retardation, jailhouse informant, snitch testimony, DNA testing, bad lawyers on the defense at the trial. I mean, one they called the bourbon cowboy, he drank so much. The other referred to his client, you know, Elmore, as the redheaded nigger. Prosecutorial misconduct, which we can come back to, but I mean, it's writ large in this case, the prosecutorial misconduct. But above all was just Elmore's claim of innocence. It was just so apparent to me as I got into the book that he was absolutely, factually, innocent beyond a scintilla of a doubt. Well, and then the other side of it was this lawyer, Diana Holt, who has her own extraordinary story to tell, overcoming immense adversity to even become a lawyer.
Well, talk about that. I mean, beginning with her own time in prison, how could she even get a law degree and a license to practice after that?
It starts even well before that. As a child growing up, from about the time she was 3 or 4 years old, she was sexually abused by her stepfather. Absolutely horrific. When she was 27, she was on her second husband, one who had tried to kill her. She had no high school diploma. And she had had this incident in Louisiana. She'd run away from home at 17, gone down to Louisiana with some people she'd met a couple of nights earlier. She was living in Houston. They ran out of money, hatched this plot where Diana would flirt with a guy. They went out to his car, and her friends ran up and stuck a gun in his head. And he reached under his seat. He was a U.S. Marshal. Nobody was killed. Nobody was hurt. But they obviously, Diana and her friends were caught. And she went to prison for 3 years, but she was a model prisoner. She got out, determined to turn her life around. She went to junior college, straight A's, Southwest Texas State straight A's, and the University of Texas admitted her. And I think the University of Texas Law School deserves a lot of credit for admitting somebody to the law school with this background.
What were Holt's key arguments that got Elmore off death row and finally released?
Well, one was that the defense lawyers were so bad, so atrocious, and they were. They did nothing. The trial took 8 days, 2 days to pick a jury. You know, you get arrested for jaywalking, and it takes them 8 days to try you. He was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death 90 days after the crime. The lawyers did nothing. And then there was prosecutorial misconduct. For example, the state said they found 53 of Elmore's pubic hairs on the victim's bed. First of all, if they did, it's the Guinness Book of Records, because the most you ever find is about 8 or 10. But they took no pictures of the bed where they supposedly found these pubic hairs, nor did they take the sheets as evidence, because they said we didn't see any stains on them. No blood, no stains, no semen. There were no hairs on the bed. And there was other evidence that the police withheld, they manufactured, and they lied. Even the Fourth Circuit, in the opinion in this case last November, used the words like deceit and dishonest when describing police conduct in this case. That's pretty strong. And it was on that basis that the Fourth Circuit ordered a new trial.
And how is Elmore reacting to freedom after 30 years behind bars for what now society agrees is something he didn't do?
Neither he nor his lawyers nor Diana Holt are very happy about having to have pled guilty to something he didn't do in order to get out of prison. But they had to. I mean, he'd been in prison for 30 years, 11,000 days, and the only way to get out was to take this plea. I was with him last Friday when he got out of prison, a week ago Friday, in court when he was released, and had lunch with him. And it was quite an uplifting experience. I mean, needless to say, he was a very, very happy.
What conclusion did you reach on who actually committed the murder?
Well, I think the evidence is overwhelming, and even the Fourth Circuit said it, that it was the next-door neighbor, Jimmy Holloway, who found the body and put on gloves and notified the police, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the evidence is quite strong, but what is clear is that Edward Lee Elmore did not commit this murder.
And what are the prospects after the dramatic reversal of the case and your book that we're going to see this saga on movie or TV screen sooner or later?
Well, you know, there have been approaches by Hollywood as well as some very, very good documentary filmmakers. You know, I think it'll be a lot for Diana and Elmore to decide what they want to do. I think the more important thing is it's still an injustice. None dare call it justice when you have to plead guilty to a crime that you did not commit in order to get out of prison. What really needs to be done now, in my view, is for a federal investigation into the violation of Elmore's civil rights, a federal investigation in which police officers are required to testify under oath about their conduct to put this man in jail for 30 years.
Former New York Times and New Yorker correspondent Ray Bonner now writes for Atlantic Magazine. His new book is Anatomy of Injustice, A Murder Case Gone Wrong from Knopf.
Next, cautiously optimistic and with reason, behind a young songwriter's star-studded debut CD, For Your Ears Only.
last verse for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. Hollywood has a new It Girl. That was the message of black and white web video in the style of the artist from the Massachusetts Republican Party mocking Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Warren's heavy entertainment industry support as Democratic opponent of incumbent GOP Senator Scott Brown, who currently leads in the polls. Now this.
As I am, as I succumb, in this moment see who I've become. When I open up my heart and I start to sing, I won't deny the songs that my past might bring. As I'm standing here all alone.
Award-winning cabaret artist Julie Rayburn sings Cautiously Optimistic, the title track of a debut CD of songs by Scott Evan Davis. But despite the priority Davis places on honesty in his lyrics, he clearly is not alone, even at this early stage in his career. Besides Rayburn, his way with words and music attracted an enviable crew of top performers from Broadway and cabaret for this new album, including Faith Prince, Liz Calloway, Jason Graw, and Natalie Douglas. And we're pleased to have Scott Evan Davis on the line now for Your Ears Only. Welcome to our show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
The CD liner notes say you didn't initially think about becoming a songwriter. So tell us where you were born, when and how making music became your life, including early appearances off Broadway.
I was born in New Jersey, in Point Pleasant, and I grew up wanting to be an actor, and I went to college for that. I think I taught myself how to play the piano when I was 12, but I never had any interest in writing music ever up until about 3 years ago. And I'm 34 now, so it happened kind of late. But I had a mentor in college who was my professor as to teach acting and musical theater as a performer. And he was sick, and he was in the last year of his life, actually, and he invited me to come and stay with him and save me money on rent. And I just ended up moving in with him, essentially, into a spare room to help him take care of himself. Anyway, I was there for about a year, and we had a horrible fight, and I moved out. I wanted to pursue other things in Boston. I ended up working in finance. It was ridiculous. But anyway, I reached out to him afterwards because I wanted to reconcile, and I found out he passed away. So that inspired me to perform again, and then a couple years after that, I did get a show off Broadway, and I was in it. And during that process, I had a dream about him. I dreamt about him, and he looked great, and he, in the dream, forgave me. But the entire time that he was in the dream, he was humming. So I woke up the next day, I couldn't get out of my head, and I went to the piano, and that became Cautiously Optimistic. And that was 3 years ago, and I have been writing ever since.
Scott, talk about the 2010 performance you gave that attracted so many veteran performers to your music and this CD.
Well, once I got a couple songs together, someone suggested that I do a show. So I was booked at Don't Tell Mamas to do a show. And, you know, I sold out the show. And someone approached me afterwards, my arranger, David Snyder, to put everything together on an album. And from there, the ball started to roll.
You used the internet to raise money for recording and production of the CD. Tell us about the role of a website called Kickstarter.
Yes, yes. Well, because, you know, when you're an independent, funding it is a bit challenging, and I got to the end of my limit. So I found out about Kickstarter, and I put together a fundraiser to raise the rest of the costs. And I raised about $5,000 through Kickstarter from the help of friends and family and supporters and fans and things like that. And I reached my goal and surpassed it, actually. It was the only reason I put out the album as quickly as I did was because of Kickstarter.
The classic question for songwriters is which comes first, the words or the music? Lyricist Sammy Kahn joked it was the phone call from stars like Frank Sinatra saying they wanted a new Christmas song. Which comes first for you?
Well, I work by titles. If I have an idea for a song, whether it's an assignment or something I just am inspired by, I sit and I think about what melody fits that particular title. Once I have the title and how that sings, I kind of go away from the piano and write the story on paper. And then once I'm happy with the way that works out on paper, I go back to the piano and I set it all to music. That seems to be my process. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Some great songs have been written in, say, 20 minutes. Others have taken weeks. What's your average for working on a song?
It ranges. Sometimes, you know, I can write a song in a week. Sometimes it's taken a month. It really depends on how the story flows in my head. I would say, on average, about 2 weeks for me to from start to finish if I really concentrate.
Before the era of singer-songwriters like Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, Carole King, there weren't all that many like Irving Berlin and Cole Porter who wrote both words and music. Now we have Stephen Sondheim. Are there some past masters of either era that you particularly appreciate or see as models?
Definitely Stephen Sondheim. I grew up listening to his work. I'm also a big, big fan of Maura Yeston and Jason Robert Brown and William Finn. I think those were my biggest inspirations growing up as a performer and also as a writer.
Are there some contemporary singers you would most like to have perform your material?
Yes, and if she's listening, I would love to have Lea Michele sing my song Ready to Fly, which is also on the album. I just think that she is wonderful. And hey, you know, she's as contemporary as I think my music can be.
And what about creating a full Broadway show, or does the massive teamwork and financial pressure involved make that seem too restrictive?
No, I'm actually thinking about it right now. I just had an idea a couple weeks ago, and I'm trying to find a good book writer to work with. I definitely would like to write a full show.
Scott Evan Davis is a songwriter, music teacher, and mentor. His debut CD is Cautiously Optimistic from Sonic Landscapes Music, with Davis himself on the final track.
I am my words, I am my doubts, I am my song, and that is who I am.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. People will shoot in other locations. That was X-rated filmmaker Stephen Hirsch on a new Los Angeles ordinance requiring condom use on screen that may move the porn industry elsewhere to avoid a presumed drop in audience appeal.
For Your Ears Only on Air is online at YouTube, iTunes, and Podcast Bunker. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donation. Please email davidearsonly@gmail.com to pledge.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at Play It Productions with interns Gene Moon and Rachel Murray. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern, acknowledging support from the nonprofit Gatewave Radio Reading Service, the century-old Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Rachel Murray. This week last year marked the start of Japan's continuing nuclear crisis. After a record earthquake and tsunami devastated large parts of the island nation and sent a seaside atomic power plant hurtling toward meltdown, from our March 13th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by David and Catherine Herzog.
Sirens and emergency warnings echoed across Japan late last week, live and via NTV television, as a killer tsunami multiplied the devastation already caused by an 8.9 magnitude earthquake that was the nation's largest for more than a century in which records have been kept. Monster waves raced at jet speed over the Pacific from Hawaii to the west coast of the United States and South America, but the most horrendous damage was concentrated in Japan itself, with a death toll in the thousands not unlikely as massive search and rescue efforts and international aid remain hindered by serious aftershocks, trash, transportation, communications, and lingering, stranding, festering floodwaters.
As if the historic natural disaster was not tragic enough, it also caused significant damage to at least one of Japan's many nuclear power plants that crippled cooling systems, causing an explosion, the release of at least some radioactive material, and fears of approaching meltdown as the government evacuated at least 45,000 people from expanding exclusion zones. To talk about that unique aspect of last week's monster quake, the danger to Japan and beyond, and to the prospects of more reliance on U.S. nuclear power, For Your Ears Only, we have Mitch Singer of the Nuclear Energy Institute in Washington. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
For a while, it seemed the Japanese nuclear plants were a bastion of quake-resistant design and preparation. Remind us just how extensive nuclear power is in that country and its reputation for safety.
They have 11 nuclear operating plants that I know of, and they have a tremendous, record of safety, given that they are very well aware of how to construct a plant and to deal with the possibility of earthquakes, given the preponderance of earthquakes in that part of Asia. I think that we have a lot of confidence in the Japanese and their engineering and construction techniques, and I think over the past 50 years or so that they have been using nuclear power, it has definitely elevated their standard of living and helped boost their economy. And if Catherine, I have to tell you that when you look at the earthquake from 4 years ago that impacted one of their other plants, the resiliency and the robust nature of that plant enabled it to withstand a pretty heavy earthquake. Not as significant as this one that we just experienced, or that they just experienced, but also it's a testament to the robust nature of those plants.
Early reports said the first explosion at the Daiichi Plant 1, 150 miles northeast of Tokyo, was a hydrogen explosion that collapsed the building's roof or walls, not a meltdown that breached the reactor's metal containment. Explain that process.
Basically, as I understand it, what has happened is that each plant between the primary and secondary containment walls, they have various levels of containment. And this explosion occurred in the secondary containment structure at about 3:36 Eastern Time. The explosion did not damage the containment function or the reactor's primary system, and there was no significant amount of radiation leakage outside the building.
Well, we heard there were traces of cesium, which comes from the nuclear fuel rods themselves. What are the signs to be looked for to indicate the more serious problem of a meltdown and container breach?
Well, a portion of the fuel was uncovered, and TETCO, the Japanese utility, measured radiation levels at the site boundary. They weren't significant, and they have been reduced since then. But there are various technical signs, including radiation levels and the temperature in the reactor core. As you may already know, David, we've seen reports of the use of borate seawater to cool the reactor. The boron in the water absorbs neutrons and prevents fission.
If there is a meltdown or several, how far beyond Japan itself might the danger extend based on prevailing winds and currents and on the experience Europe had from the Chernobyl disaster?
There's really no way, Catherine, to tell at this point in time because you don't know what the climatic conditions would be if such an unlikely event should occur.
Is that something that they can follow, though? Can you actually watch a plume? Can you follow the winds accurately?
I don't believe so.
What kind of preventive actions can we expect to see in potentially affected areas? Treatments for water supplies, anti-radiation medications, iodine?
Yes. It's our understanding that the TEPCO has been issuing potassium iodide pills, which are used to protect the thyroid. They also implemented an evacuation plan of up to 20 kilometer radius around the plant. 20 kilometers, about 12 miles.
Speaking of evacuation, how much work can safely go on at the plant after an explosion like we've seen and the possible developing of a meltdown?
They can continue to monitor the plant and to do whatever is necessary to maintain it in a safe mode. They have very sophisticated preventive measures for the workers there, that radiation suits, detectors that they wear that are they're like badges that tell you exactly what the radiation levels are. And from all indications, it seems like the radiation levels are still relatively minimum and within the safety margins as prescribed by their governing and regulatory agency.
What lessons from the Japanese situation are already looking most important for the U.S. nuclear industry?
I think the key overall overriding message is preparation for all contingencies, which the nuclear industry as a habit does, which we do especially in the U.S. I think another thing that we will be looking at is there will be an exhaustive investigation into the root causes of what's happened at the plant, and the industry worldwide will place additional or improve preventive measures.
Clearly, the Japanese disaster will have an effect on Americans thinking about nuclear power and nuclear safety. Remind us about the safety initiative the U.S. nuclear industry adopted at the end of last year.
This industry has and always will put safety as its top priority. I mean, it is the linchpin to the success of this industry. The initiative in place last year mandates that each company operating a nuclear power plant implement a guidance that was developed by the Nuclear Energy Institute in partnership with other members, the member companies, and with the Institute of Nuclear Power Operators in Atlanta. This has to be implemented by October 1st, 2011. Using this guidance, the companies that operate plants will standardize the program to effectively assess nuclear safety culture on a regular basis to provide input for senior managers and to implement improvement programs as warranted. But I have to tell you that this is something that has been ingrained in the culture of everybody who works in this industry, that safety is the top priority. If we don't operate safely, we don't operate at all.
Safety is obviously key, but accidents do happen. How do you expect this to impact Americans' attitudes towards nuclear power and this new call for more reactors, new reactors in the country?
I think it's too soon to tell. It's virtually impossible to predict attitudes in a fluid situation such as this, for which we don't know the ultimate outcome. I would say that the American people, as we can see as of now, are wisely taking a wait-and-see position to see how the Japanese deal with the situation. One thing I can say is that this industry is in a consistent, lifelong learning mode. We are never satisfied, no matter how successful we are, how safe we operate our plants. We are always looking for any way that we can to improve it, and we will continue to do so.
Mitch Singer of the Nuclear Energy Institute in Washington.
Quake gone nuclear. From our March 13th, 2011 broadcast, and at least somewhat optimistic as we all subsequently learned, an independent commission recently faulted cozy Japanese government and utility conduct in the crisis for indecision, bad judgment, incomplete information, and communication. Nearly all the country's nuclear plants, which had supplied 30% of its electric power, are now offline for the foreseeable future. In the United States, however, professionals of the American Nuclear Society last week found current levels of atomic plant oversight sufficient, and the atomic power industry touted progress on its new flex response strategy, including acquisition of additional portable equipment on-site to assure safe shutdowns after extreme events, no matter what the cause. I'm Rachel Murray. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, with the past, present, and future of nuclear energy in mind, more of that appropriately titled song, Cautiously Optimistic, by Scott Evan Davis.
My hands are shaking. My throat is dry. And my fear begins to multiply. And my head begins to pound like a thousand drums. I try to keep my strength as my body numbs. And I'm standing here alone. And my mind has been broken. My heart has been spinning. The silence was spoken as the end was beginning. And my tears kept collapsing as the world went on streaming. I was screaming without sound. But now I'm cautiously optimistic. Yes, I'm cautiously optimistic. With one foot. Twice as strong. Now. okay to be lonely. It's the only way I found to stay cautiously optimistic. I'll be cautiously optimistic.